Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam saṅkhaṃ namassāmi. I was at the Quaker meeting last night, yesterday evening in town, in Ottawa. And I guess we had about 50 people there, roughly. And the chanting was very beautiful, same chanting that we do here. And I was reflecting on when we started those Quaker meetings about 10 years ago, I think. We had four or five people. And I'm the only one that knew the chanting. And I just kept doing it, doing it, doing it. And now you have this lovely sense of a congregation chanting together. And there's something quite uplifting, I find, about that when a group of people develop a form, a common form, a ritual, and then they use it for a kind of sense of uplift in this kind of endeavor that we're involved in. It's not necessary. We could just plunk ourselves down and put on a buzzer and then leave. But I think there's a certain amount of beauty in that. So I quite like ritual if it's not superstition. I'm not up for superstition. And in many ways, like we're a very orthodox tradition, orthodox in the sense that we come from a tradition in Thailand which has a lot of structure and form. So Venerable Pumuto and I sit here, and this is a very kind of high church situation, with a lot of formality. Other times there's less formality. When we're on the work site, it's obviously different. And that kind of formality is one of the ways that my teachers taught me to cultivate awareness, cultivate a sense of care, cultivate a sense of intention. So a shrine room like this is, you could say it's just bricks and mortar or wood and plasterboard. But it does have a certain energy to it, doesn't it? When you come in and you look at the Buddha Rupa and you feel the energy of the room. There is a sense about it, isn't there? And then just coming together as a group of people and doing the rituals and doing the chanting. At first, you Westerners feel very awkward with all this. Is this really necessary? And can't we just get enlightened and do meditation and all this bowing stuff? And gosh, why don't they use English? And the mind can do all of that. So it does take some adjustment to maybe to get used to it, but and some people won't like it, and some people will like it more. It's not necessary. So when you come to this monastery, don't feel compelled that you have to follow the rituals. And just look, just observe how the rituals affect you. So I know when people first come, they usually come as anthropologists. I just sit in the back and they look, and what are these guys about anyway? Are they safe or what's going on? Or which everyone does. But if you get the spirit of it and you get a feeling for it, then it connects you to a tradition, something bigger than one's own particular meditation. It connects you to what we mean as sangha, the community of practitioners. So the ritual, the language of the ritual. The pace of the chanting, the meaning of the chanting. After a while, it's quite intuitive, and it intuitively brings you to that sense of aspiration to the spiritual part of our life. Just because that's the way the mind, one of the ways the mind gets conditioned is like if I do something associated with meditation. And I repeat that, then when I do that, it's like an entry into my meditation practice. It's very, very helpful. Again, not necessary, but so And Yaniko was doing this chant, and that chant was requesting a Dharma talk. And that's another kind of formal aspect of this kind of situation. And then, because a monk can't teach or a nun can't teach unless they're invited to teach. But if you come on a Saturday, even if you don't ask, I'll teach. I'll just do it. But if that's part of what I like about a monastery is a sense of community growing little by little through a sense of association and a sense of common aspiration, and that's not really demanding a certain kind of belief structure. You know, it's not like you have to convert to something, not at all really. It's more like we are aspiring to some sense of peace and inner stillness. We might define it in different ways for ourselves, and then when a group of people do that, it really helps. It helps to enhance that and remind us of that. And then all of us will experiment with the different kinds of teachings we find fruitful. So something like a place like this is not like it's not forbidden for Christians to come or Jewish people to come or even Buddhists to come. Because those are just the labels, aren't they? You know, the kind of labels that culture uses, Christian, Buddhist, and they have certain cultural associations. But the path that I find very helpful is a path which is a path of awakening rather than a path of belief. And that does not require a doctrinal allegiance. You know, I don't even have to believe in the Buddha to notice that this is the way it is now. And there's no demand in that way. And I think all of us probably, you know, we have a similar aspiration because we've seen belief structures and we've seen the conflicts of attachment to beliefs and attachment to views. And I just overheard a story about two people who were asked to do some mindfulness training at a certain place, and they got into an argument about what mindfulness was, and it was quite heated, and the person that was organizing this course in mindfulness watched these two people arguing about mindfulness, and they, well, that's interesting. I wonder if they noticed that they were arguing. So the tendency of the human mind to take positions and have beliefs and then find security in those beliefs and then find conflict and alienation because of those beliefs can be known. And I can know that. I can know that your views are different than my views, that you see life in a different way. And yet both of us, that knowing is the same. That knowing, because that knowing or that awareness of my inner the movements of my mind is not a condition. You know, it's not like it's not a belief system. So even if you disagree with me and I disagree with you, but I'm mindful of the very sense of conflict which arises with disagreement, and I make that more important than my need to dominate you with my ideas or my fear of you because you don't like my ideas or whatever. If I make mindfulness of that very sense of believing or disbelieving, liking or disliking, then that's what we call transcendence. You're transcending the tendency to take positions. And that goes beyond thought. It's bigger than thought. So thought in right thinking in Buddhism is a tool rather than an end in itself. You know, it's a tool we use to bring the mind to stillness rather than finding false confidence in views and beliefs. Certainly, I find, you know, we find that in monasticism. Monks will pick up an idea and they'll read texts and they'll say, this is really what the Buddha taught. And whenever I hear that, or whenever I see the book, what the Buddha really taught, I kind of cringe. You know, here's some person after 2.5 millennia, now I know what the Buddha really taught. So, what I think the spiritual life is not the confidence in the spiritual life, I don't think is part of an intellectual position, but we have intellect. So how do we use intellect that takes us beyond doubt? Intellect can be, like thinking, can be analytical. So we use thinking maybe in terms of, like I'm going to Latvia tomorrow. So there's a lot of thinking going on projects that are going on here, and making sure I don't forget my passport, and finishing off my emails. And so that's a kind of productive or marginally productive use of thought. Yeah? And that needs to be done. So that's what we call the conditioned world. And in the conditioned world, we have this kind of movement back and forth, that their life comes at me, and then I respond from that, from my own need to respond. So Venerable Pumutu asks me a question, what should we do with this? And then I respond with an answer. So life is this, the conditioned life is this action-response. I feel hot, I turn on the fan, my knee hurts, I shift out of the position to get a more comfortable position, end of the day, I'm tired, I lay down. So there's this kind of action-response, and that's the flow of condition and phenomena that come and go. That's quite natural, isn't it? And in that flow of conditions, we have a certain amount of intelligence, and it's probably a certain amount of stupidity. You know, sometimes we respond quite clearly with clarity and intelligence, and sometimes we react, and those reactions sometimes reverberate through our consciousness, preoccupy our consciousness for a long, long time. And they're suffering, aren't they? When something happens and I respond skillfully, I do what I have to do, then there's no echo. You know, there isn't a kind of preoccupation with what happened. But if there's some kind of input, and then I get upset by that input, or I react through that input, and that whole scenario echoes and carries on through my consciousness for half a day or whatever, I know there's something off there. What's going on there? Why can't it just flow? And those areas where my mind, my attention gets very, very preoccupied, we're trying to very much awaken to that and understand that. Why are these modes of suffering called worry or resentment or anxiety or hopelessness, or all these different things where we get very much stuck. We get very much stuck in the flow of, in the ebb and flow of life. So we're on one hand, we're dealing with this ebb and flow, but you notice that the ebb and flow is never, you never get it right. And it's never finished, is it? Is anyone ever finished? Is your garden ever finished? Is a monastery ever finished? Are your emotions ever right? Are your relationships ever really balanced? Yeah, they, every now and then they're in balance, and then they fall apart. So this ebb and flow of life, we do our best to make it as good as we can. So monastic life, we work very hard to keep the place tidy and clean, and to, you know, try to build it and make it a nice place and so on, and we try to live in harmony. But there's always hassles, there's always misunderstandings, and broken machinery, we're good at that. We're very good at that. And you know, and the grass is always too long, and the ticks are biting us. But that's just very natural. That's the way the ebb and flow of life is. And if we're trying to find freedom or happiness in that ebb and flow, then I would say we can get a certain amount of efficiency in that part of our life. You know, we can live morally. We can try to develop skills of communication and craft skills and so on, and we need to do all of that. But there's a real limit to that, isn't there? You know, as much as you try to be a good communicator, and as much as you really try to be, you know, efficient in worldly manual things and so on and so forth, it's never quite right, is it? it's never quite right. Even your own intentions, sometimes you make like very good intentions to speak wholesomely, to try to be a compassionate person, to try to be generous, and you blow it. You know, you don't do it on purpose. None of us do. You don't wake up in the morning, say 4 o'clock, I'm going to blow it. You don't do that. And we do. We get upset, and then we find ourselves kind of getting uptight about something. Like, why am I getting uptight about this? You know, what's the problem? And so this ebb and flow of life, we sometimes put too much into it, and we invest too much into it because we think that that is where we can find perfection, or we can find a certain amount of goodness, certainly. Yeah, so we do, you know, like this kind of a place is a good place, isn't it? It is a refuge. It is a good place. But it sure ain't perfect. Now, I think that I could make a perfect monastery. I'm in deep trouble. I've been at it enough to know that monasteries aren't perfect. But they're not bad. They're not bad places. They're good places. It can be goodness. So in our practice of Dhamma, we're trying to also remember that there is a place which is not a part of this ebb and flow. And it's not a function of this ebb and flow. It's not a reaction within this ebb and flow of life. It's not an input and an output. It's not an action and a response. I suggest you have a look at this, by the way. This just came in our free posts. This is Still Flowing Water, a new translation of some of Ajahn Chah's teachings. They're there. But we were reading this, and he was giving this image of one of the analogies or paradoxes, which I've always liked of his. It's the image of still flowing water. Still flowing water. So that's a paradox, isn't it? Still flowing water. And in this meditation here, what I suggested is you feel, what did I start? I started with the wind, right? So the feeling of the fan on your skin, so coolness. And then I suggested the heat, or the body, and then feeling of your hands. So I did sound, body. And they're changing, aren't they? So you hear the sound of the fan, and that's changing. And your body responds to that. There's coolness. You hear the sound of the birds or whatever. You feel your body. So these are the conditions of consciousness, bodily feelings, tactile feelings, sounds, sights, tastes, audio things, mental things, emotion things. And these are all part of the ebb and flow of life. And then I suggested, well, notice that this is taking place in awareness. This is taking place in awareness. That's not something you have to do, not believe in. If you take this as an absolute philosophy, then you make something out of awareness that it is whatever. But if you just do that, and if you follow that instruction, at least when I follow my own instruction, I listen, I feel. I listen, I feel. So I toggle between those two. Listen, feel, listen, feel. And then I get a sense, yeah, there's that stillness behind it. So the feeling of the fan, the tactile sensations in your body, the sound of a robin, that's the flowing waters. And then the knowing is the stillness, still flowing water. Now, for the most part, a person who doesn't have a kind of inclination to spiritual life or that life of silence, they tend to always just try to make the flow of water to be pleasant, and or just survive the rapids, or try to dam it up. So the attention is always in the water, rather than seeing that the water is in awareness. In awareness. That is very subtle, right? And yet it's not so far away. And it's not something that you can't really believe in this. You have to give it a go. Give it a go and try it. And I don't know, when I try that, it always comes back to the same silence. It's not a different silence. It's not a more... whatever, it's just silence. It might become more profound and more more real or something like that. Now that's different, you see, so that is a different sort of option to trying to reorganize the sounds and reorganize the space and reorganize the people and make the perfect monastery. But we can do both, and we need to do both. We need to be efficient. So if Tina didn't work diligently on the accounts, we'd have a lot of problems. If Nyaniko and Philip and others didn't cook in the kitchen, I would starve, right? If we didn't pay our electricity bills and so on and so forth. So we need to address that. We need to do that well. We need to be skillful in that way. But is that all there is? Is that just life, just about keeping the stream of water from drowning us or just surfing all the time? Well, I would say that there's a kind of maturity in consciousness where you watch this ebb and flow, you work at getting it right, you know, so then you do it for 20 years, 30 years, right? And then you start to get this inkling, wait a minute. And just maybe I'm just looking in the wrong place. You know, maybe it's not about getting it perfect on that level. Maybe it's kind of a different dimension. Sometimes that happens. We have, like in meditation, we have an experience that really, where there's a sense of bringing silence in the mind, we notice that, what's that about? Or sometimes we just become, we see the same cycles. If it's not one thing, it's another. We just become kind of disenchanted with this whole play and struggle in the river. And people might say to us, oh, no, the river's fine. You have to just try harder. Get a better boat, right? You know, put a motor on the boat. Paddles? Sails? And so people quite often will feel worried if they feel some disenchantment maybe, or they'll tell you that you should be worried, and you know that you should be inspired by all this. And yet, now the ebb and flow of this conscious experience is very much dualistic, pleasant, unpleasant, comfortable, uncomfortable, harmony, disharmony. And obviously we choose harmony and comfort and beauty and whatever we like in that duality. But as this teaching was saying, if you prefer one and hold to that one, then the other one's going to really give you a problem. But if you work towards a certain amount of harmony and goodness and beauty in your life, but you realize that that's just something, you got to do something in life, so you might as well live harmoniously, better than living in disharmony. But you realize that can't be the ultimate goal, that your ultimate goal is something much deeper and much more right here and now. So one gives to one's culture, one gives to one's community, one tries to help and serve and so on, and that brings a certain amount of joy. Doesn't it? When I can serve and help and I can see that other people benefit from that, that gives me a certain uplift. And that uplift is not the same as me trying to control the river. It's me participating in the river of life in a way which is not a demand that the river of life fulfill my desires, that the river of life fulfill my design, you know, like I'm a river designer, as it were. And that's why giving is so important, isn't it? You know, when I give and I serve and I just do it because I know it's right, then I'm still participating in the river. There's still action and response. But now it's coming from a place that's not my real home. I won't find fulfillment in giving, but giving can be very rewarding. So it gives my mind a certain uplift. But if you look at something like meanness of spirit, meanness of heart, you know, like, leave me alone, I'm meditating. Right, I'm trying to get enlightened. Get off my back, or you know, you ruined my meditation. No space. There's no space because what? Because I'm getting enlightened. Hopeless. That's a hopeless task. Hopeless task. And yet, we'll find in like sometimes I think North American Buddhism has a kind of bias towards meditation, the meditation retreats. So sometimes people will. We'll think, you know, that you know, where it's really at is meditation, and the rest of life is just, you know, it's like a sandwich, you know, only the fill is important, not the bread. So that, you know, like the people will just think the meditation is where it's at, but the rest of life, the communication I have, the work I do and all of that, that's just the filler. I'll get rid of that and then I'll meditate, I'll do retreats. But all of life is the flow and the ebb and flow. And all of life is an opportunity of awakening within that flow. So to see spiritual life as something which is always embedded in all of life, in family life, in professional life, in whatever life brings up. So to cultivate the cultivation of the qualities of a good life that the Buddha suggested, like morality, non-violence, non-corruption, fidelity, sobriety, communication which is harmonious and beautiful. These are still in the flow of life. These are still part of the river of life. So they're the method. They're the method for not getting swamped by the river, not getting lost in the currents of the river's flow. Because if we don't get those right, then you know, like say someone gets tempted to work in a place called the Senate and they cheat on their expenses, and then they thought, well, who's going to know, I'll just double dip, and so on and so forth. When people find out, then their minds are obsessed with not getting caught, right? And that's fear, and that fear comes from immoral action. So one can see that the more integrity one has in this flow of life, the more responsible one is in this flow of life, the more one tries to fulfill one's responsibilities. It's not an end in itself. I mean, that's not enough, but it is necessary. It's not enough just to be moral, but it is necessary to be moral. It's not enough just to be generous, but it is necessary to be generous. So the activity, the social activity that involved in, doesn't come from fear. It doesn't come from a sense of obligation or I must do this. It comes from wisdom. It comes from intelligence, doesn't it? Like harmlessness, ahimsa, comes from intelligence. I don't harm beings because I don't want beings to be harmed. I don't like to be harmed. So there's an intelligence operating there. And this is a foundation for enlightenment or the method of enlightenment. Compassion. Compassion is a method, it's not an end in itself. And that, if you think about like the energies of compassion, they come from the golden rule. I don't like to be abused. And just as I don't like to abuse, you don't like to be abused, I'm not going to abuse you. Right? And that's participating in the flow of the river in a way which is not selfish. It's unitary. I see in you the same things that I see in myself. I know you don't like pain. I don't like pain. How can I facilitate your life so you don't have pain? That's different than trying to exploit you or manipulate you or whatever. So the flow of life then, I participate in that from compassion. So compassion is the method for me being able to know the stillness. Right? Compassion, which is not intelligent, can learn to burn out, certainly. I can be so concerned about you that I completely lose my bearing and just get totally overwhelmed and burnt out because I'm so caring of you. But that's a mistake. So compassion, generosity, morality, these are, I mean, we all know that stuff, don't we? You know, we've heard it lots of times. But this the Buddhist path is not just about being a goody good person. So it's like if I think that the goal is to be compassionate and the goal is to be generous, and then one day I'm feeling bloody minded and no, you can't have my ice cream, I'm going to eat it all myself, then I can feel very guilty about that. Like, oh dear, I'm not generous, or oh dear, I'm just really angry. But the goal isn't to always be compassionate, it's just the method. So when I don't feel compassion, you know, this is what not wanting to be compassionate feels like. Then I come back to where my true refuge is, and that's the knowing, the awareness of the mind. But I don't follow that, you know, so if there are manipulative energies or domineering energies or arrogant energies that come up in consciousness, that's fine. They're not wrong. They're just part of the flow of the river. But I know if I invest in those, then they suck me into the eddies and currents of the river. But if I think I shouldn't feel arrogant or that I shouldn't feel domineering or whatever, then I still get sucked into the eddies because I'm caught in the conditions. And I'm still in the river. And some, that's very much a problem in the spiritual life. Most people who come here are really beautiful intentions. They're trying really hard to do the best they can. But the conditions of mind that they experience are sometimes not so pretty, not so beautiful. They might be quite childish or adolescent or fearful or whatever. And then from a misunderstanding of the teaching, they begin to judge themselves that they shouldn't feel that. But that's still being caught in the river, isn't it? So when you feel arrogant, you feel arrogant. Well, arrogant feels this way, but one tries not to invest any sense of self into it, tries not to follow it. One tries to ride it out. And the more you ride those negative energies of corruption and foolishness and stupidity, the more you ride them out, the less power they have. You get into still flowing water. The water is much more still itself. The river is much more still. And that's training. That's training in body, speech, and mind. But the real interesting thing, I think, really, because I think we've heard lots of things about living a good life, is that we're not always into a self-help mode. And that's the danger of always trying to make the conditions right. There's a sense of that I'm always just kind of working on myself and being a better person, which is fine, but how many self-help books have you seen? How many are there in the market? But transcendence is different. It's not like becoming a perfect person. It's knowing that imperfections come and go. The sense of imperfection or whatever it might be. And that stillness, when we listen to the fan, and when we feel the body, listen to the fan, that stillness is it's beyond those. It's not that. So our practice is to try to live a good life, but not seek ourselves in that which is unreliable, but rather find our real home in that silent witnessing of the way of things as they change. So let's say I feel some really negative and nasty piece of emotional material comes up into my mind, like hopelessness or despair or doubt or something like that. We all get those things. And hopelessness, like hopelessness, is a really difficult state of mind to know because it seems so hopeless. And hopelessness seems eternal, doesn't it? If you can remember when you felt hopeless, it feels like it'll never change. It feels eternal. And yet if you have the willingness to witness to it, and it's very hard to do, actually, when you get a really difficult, negative state of mind, to stop and sit down. It doesn't have to be on a meditation cushion, just to stop and then, this is what it feels like to be, it's hopeless. You don't want to go there. You want to run away from that and seek some kind of compensation. But if you can just go to it, like, okay, what does it feel like to feel hopeless? Let's have it. Come on, stay for 20 years, I'll have you. Then you face it like a fact, and it's not a problem because you're back in the stillness of knowing. But the resolution to go to that hopelessness or despair or whatever, self-hatred or whatever, just to know it as a fact, it's just that way, is quite hard. It's quite hard because we don't want to feel that. We want to run away from it. But where we run to is just another part of the river. We run into self-hatred or self-analysis or ice cream cones or whatever we do. And you want to kind of get out of the river, don't you? You want to just see, oh, that's just the river. So whether it's beautiful or ugly, that's just the river. That's the river flowing. So I recommend to people to get a feeling for this stillness by taking something simple, sound, hand, tactile. You just like toggle between something very simple, not threatening, not emotionally powerful, and get a sense of the beauty of that. And then recognize, that's it, okay, that's the practice. And then the more you recognize that with intelligence, the more you'll remember it when things become more complex. You might have to remind yourself, but if you do that, you'll recognize that's it. And then one day you find yourself coming back to that reference of stillness, knowing, turbulence, automatically. because you've done it more and more and more. But you begin with something very simple, not complicated. And then the complex stuff challenges you to remember that. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayangamakataya sadhukaranga dhammasi.